This is a Gathering History Project podcast recorded in the Louth County Museum in Dundalk, Ireland. Now, I'm delighted to welcome to the Louth County Museum here in Dundalk for the Gathering History Project 2013, Tom Savage. Tom is a Cooley man and he's the current chairman of the RTE board, which he was appointed to in 2009. You're very, very welcome to our project, Tom.
Thanks very much, Harry. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, I say this to most people in the Cooley area. Were you a Cooley man or a Dundalk man?
Oh, I mean, absolutely a Cooley man. Let there be no doubt about it. Born and bred Cooley, and that's how I identify myself.
And so if people say, do you come from Dundalk, you'd say, no, I come from Cooley.
I would, although even worse than that, and I use the word advisedly. First of all, as you've introduced me, you know my name is Savage. And I actually come from a very small area in Cooley, which is known as the Bush. And if you grow up as a kid saying you're Savage from the Bush, you're liable to get a lot of humour. It's a bit like A Boy Named Sue, the Johnny Cash song. So I come from the Bush, and I used to say that and was always proud of it.
Been out in, shall we say, the country, did you come into Dundalk much during your time as a child out there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Dundalk, I mean, when I say that I'm a Cooley man, that doesn't mean that it's anti-Dundalk. I mean, Dundalk is and was always our local town. That was the big day out. To get on the train into Dundalk was the highlight of a week. That's where you hoped that mother would be going as often as possible into various shops and that in Dundalk. So I would have a huge identification with Dundalk, the town, for years.
School. Which school did you go to out there?
It's now you won't find it, but it was Monksland National School, which was just as part of what's now the New Road as you head towards Greenore. And all my primary schooling was in Monksland National School.
Were the happy days for you, Tom? Do you look back on them now? I mean, you've done so much in your life, looking up your researching a bit about you. I couldn't cope with all the things you've done. But were the happy days when you, do you look back on them fondly?
I do, actually, and I'm always slightly intrigued, puzzled and disappointed when I hear people talking about the miserable days that they were at school, either primary or secondary, because I actually loved all the time that I was at school. And the only thing was, I went exceedingly young because my mother was a marvellous woman who worked all her life at a time when women did not work all the time. And she did until she was in her 70s. And as a result, she had the 6 children. She always wanted to get back to work. So she went to the teacher in the school when I was about 3 and a half and said, well, he's house trained and I think he's bright enough. Would you let him into the school? So I actually started my primary education at about 3 and a half. And as a result, all of my education, I hit marks in age that were ahead of where they would normally be. So that I was finished primary school at about 10. I was finished secondary school at 16. All that sort of thing.
Most people, or a lot of people, as you rightly say there, look back at some of the teachers in the schools as being very difficult, very hard teachers in those days, you know. And but how do you look back at your teachers in when you went to school first?
Well, I think I can understand how some people have a negative image. But I would say 2 things about school. I think if you're reasonably bright, and I don't want to sort of boast about myself, but if you're bright at your subject areas, it's very hard for the teacher to come down on you very hard. And all during my primary school, I knew that if anybody came in, whether that was the local priest or a visitor or a kiggera, as we used to call them, that I'd be sort of wheeled out to answer this question or that question. So that I always got on well with the 2 teachers. I only had 2 teachers in my life in primary school, partly, I suspect, because I was regarded as being fairly smart.
When you went through primary school, was there much sport out there? I know it's a great area, and I know you're very much involved in Cooley Kickhams and the GAA in general out there, but was there much sport in when you were young out there?
The fascinating thing there was, yes, but not in our school, and that's a very interesting thing, because I have great pride in the fact that all the other schools and in the areas out there had football teams at under 14 level, which was, for young people, the magical time, playing under 14 schools football. And one day, myself, brothers and a couple of other lads were playing on the public road outside our house, and a priest, well-known priest in GAA circles called Father Keelan, who was based in Carlingford, pulled up in his car and he said, "Young Savage." I said, "Yes, Father." "I see you're playing football." "Yeah." "Well, we have a seven-a-side in Carlingford in the summer. I know that you probably don't have 14 players for a team here. Could you get seven young fellas with you to come in and play in our seven-a-side tournament?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I probably could." And miracle of miracles, we won it. And as a result, Grange National School formed a team for the first time in its history.
That's how it started.
That's exactly how it started. And what was more, in the first round of that competition in Carlingford, we played Bar B team. Now, Bar were the big team at the time. They won all the trophies under 14. So we played their B team in the first round, and we won. And their A team came and said, "Oh, you think yous are great. Wait till we get yous in the final." So we went into the final, and we beat Bar A. It was a miracle. Miracle.
That's great memory.
Oh, we enjoyed that enormously, I can tell you.
Tom, where did you move to then, and did you find a big change moving from a small school in Bush? Where exactly did you go to after that?
Well, I was very surprised when one day my mother said, "You're going down to the school on your own to do an examination." I had no idea what this was about. But what had happened was a priest had arrived in the parish, and he said to my mother, I didn't know it at the time, "Oh, I think your man's fairly smart. We should put him in for the entrance examination to St. Patrick's in Armagh, St. Patrick's College." Now, I never heard of St. Patrick's College, and I assumed I'd be going either, as we called it, to the Tech or to the CBS in Dundalk, because that's where, if you're going to secondary school, that's where you went. And suddenly I was told I was doing an entrance exam for St. Pat's in Armagh. So I went and did the exam, and the next thing I knew, I got a scholarship, because as a family, we would not have been able to afford going to a boarding school if I didn't get the scholarship. So not only did I go, but my poor three brothers who followed me, because I was the eldest of the boys, followed suit. So they all ended up in St. Pat's in Armagh.
And St. Pat's in Armagh, was that a very Catholic school, or was it a secondary school like the Christian Brothers? And
oh,
all
very
that?
Much very Catholic, and run by the Vincentian Fathers. And I have to say, run marvellously by the Vincentian Fathers. Because when I went to Maynooth later on, at the finish of my schooling in Armagh, I heard the lads in my own class in Maynooth talking about their secondary school days, and all of them pretty much talking negatively about them, about seminaries, as they called them, where they said, oh, priests taught them and they went way off and it wasn't enjoyable. The Vincentians were terrific. They managed us down on the sports fields. They taught us things. They really were an example of how you should run a boys' school. But I would have to say that boarding school for boys can be very difficult places. But again, I was lucky in that academically I succeeded, but maybe as importantly, I was very good at sport. And if you had those two things on your favour, you tended to avoid the difficulties that many other young boys had at the age of 11 or 12 when they went to secondary school.
Was that the reason, was the seed sown for you to think about becoming a priest in that school?
Oh, it was sown earlier than that, because one of the most magnificent men that I ever knew, and I still have the fondest of memories of him, was a man called Father McNamee, Father Peter McNamee, who was a curate in Cooley. And he was simply a lovely man. And he interacted very closely, particularly with my grandfather, after whom I was named, a man known as Tommy Savage, who was one of the relatively wealthy men in Cooley at the time, because some of his sons were builders, he had a farm, he had a shop, etc. And Father McNamee was a good friend of his, but was also a good friend of ours. And I just found him a marvellous man, and what he represented to me showed all the things that were good about human beings. And he also challenged me intellectually, because I still remember when I was quite young, him coming to me one day and saying, "How many persons are there in God?" And I said, "There are three persons." "No," I said, "no, sorry, Father, there's not. There's only one person in God." But he says, there's God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. That's three, isn't it? And I said, no. But he says, isn't that three? I've just counted them out. And yet you tell me there's only one God. So I was always totally nonplussed as to how this mystery of religion. But he kept challenging me about it.
So
did I never quite solved it, by the way, Harry.
You're still waiting. And Tom, was the idea of becoming a priest, did he set the scene for you?
Well, he certainly was a model. And I remember I decided that I would like to go on the missions. I mean, go out to foreign, bring the message of the gospel, the good message, to people who didn't know about it. But then somebody came to me in Armagh. This goes back to the academic thing, because again, academically, I did well at college. And they said, no, you shouldn't be going away. You should be serving the home ministry. And I was pointed in the direction of Maynooth. I wasn't forced to go, but I was told that we need people like you to be here in the home ministry. So as a result, instead of going to one of the orders or to one of the schools that would have prepared you for the missions, I went to Maynooth.
What was the feeling of your family, your mum particularly, for you to take up to be a priest?
Oh, delighted, I have no doubt. I mean,
that was a part of their family, if somebody could be a priest.
Oh, yeah, I mean, but I mean, for anybody at the time, I mean, let's face it, I mean, the numbers applying to get into Maynooth, when we went in, there was 112. I think there's about four this year. So there was huge applications from various what were called minor seminaries all over the country to get into Maynooth. It had a huge reputation for academic standards in Maynooth. You could do your university training as well. So Maynooth itself was seen as a terrific place to go. It was top of the mark as far as somewhere that would stretch you intellectually as well as spiritually.
A huge part of your life was been involved in communications, and there was part of this, the seed again was sown, I keep saying that to you, but the seed again was sown during the time of you being a priest in Armagh.
Yeah, it was, but I mean, when you come to communications, I still remember when I was in Maynooth, my professor of elocution said to me one day, Savage, if I spoke like you, I would never speak in public at all. And I didn't disagree with him, because remember, I was there in the age of what was called received pronunciation. You had to speak in a very particular way, you had to have a very particular tone, you had to project your voice in a very particular way. And if you happened to speak with traces of a loud accent, you know, like a clock and a box or whatever you had when you came from Dundalk, you know, then it wasn't seen as being the best sort of training to be in communications. So I had no great notions about myself as a communicator. I just talked as it came to me, and that was all. It was accidental how I got into communications later on as a career.
Now, one of the things that fascinated me in your the research I was doing for you was when you were sent up to welcome the British soldiers, and because they were supposed to be the saviours of everything, and when you look back on it now, it was, there's so much happened after that. Do you remember that distinctly?
Oh, indeed I do very well, but it also showed you how clever politically was the then Cardinal Conway. Because the invite actually was extended to him and Archbishop George Otto Sims, who was the Protestant Archbishop of Armagh. And very interestingly, at the time, the question used to be put out, in which city or town does the Catholic William look across at the Catholic James? Because later on, the Archbishop of Armagh was a man whose name was James, which was reversing the roles of the Boyne, if you know what I mean. But at that date, the Archbishop of Armagh, the Protestant Archbishop of Armagh, was George Otto Sims, a lovely man, an absolutely lovely man. So he and Cardinal Conway were invited. But the Cardinal decided that might be a bit much for a Falls Road man to be seen to welcome the troops. And because I was working very closely with them, he designated me to be the one standing with the Archbishop to welcome the troops. And they were seen genuinely as a welcome, not just in Armagh. Armagh was where they were billeted. But in fact, the main welcome was for the job that they were able to do to protect the nationalist population in Belfast.
How long did you remain in the priesthood?
from, I was ordained in 1964, and I left in the crossover between 72 and 73. So 8 years.
Was it a difficult time for you, making up your mind to leave?
No, indeed it wasn't, because first of all, as a priest, I had marvellous opportunities. By accident, I got into communication. So as well as doing the ordinary things that I did, including being based here in Dundalk, I also had a building and the beginnings of a career in radio and television broadcasting, religious broadcasting. So there were plenty of challenges. But as far as the divinity was concerned, I've always believed, Harry, that in life, if you have great difficulty in making a decision, you're probably indecisive. I had no difficulty making the decision. I had a huge difficulty in thinking about how I would live with the consequences of the decision. Because I knew that, first of all, it was going to break the hearts of the two people I loved more than anyone in the world, my parents. So the decision was easy. I felt I need to leave here. I can't represent what I'm expected to represent anymore. But look at the fallout. Look at the collateral damage that's going to fall out from it. So that's what I mean by, at one level it was dead easy, at another level it was the most difficult decision I ever had to make in my life.
Can you remember the day that you told your mum and dad that you were leaving?
Oh, I did. I mean, absolutely. That probably, when I look back, was the most difficult day ever of my life. Even though it's also the day of which I'm proudest of. Because if you do something that you believe you have to do because it represents what your conscience is telling you to do. See, I felt that I wasn't making any different decision the day I decided to leave as I did the day I decided to be a priest. It was the same decision that in the life of all that I know, this is what I feel I am committed to do, to be true to myself. The fact that as a fallout from it, it absolutely would have caused such heartache to people that I loved and were very close to me. That was a huge problem.
Where did you go immediately after that? Had you a job set up, or were you unemployed, or what happened in the time that you left until you started working in the communication business?
Well, in fact, the two of them were tied together because, you see, any of my friends who were in the priesthood at the time, nationally and even some international men that I knew, because I had a reasonably extended reputation as a priest, because I was a social scientist, I was talking nationally at congresses and so on, and therefore I knew quite a number of men both in Britain and in America. And I knew that when they left where they were. I mean, any of my friends who left here left the country. And when I was leaving, because I had appeared on radio and particularly on television in the era when, if you even appeared in the audience of a Late Late Show, you were famous. So if you appeared on television as I did, everybody knew your dial. And people said, you'll never get a job. Nobody will ever employ you. You're too well known. You'll always be known as Father Tom Savage. And I sat down and said, right, everybody else is going away, but I'm not going away. I'm going to stay. Because I believe that I represent something that was true about me, and I don't see why I should hide from it. So I said to myself, but you're going to spend a life with Father stuck to the front of your name. And the only way I can change that is by going into some profession where I'm allowed to put back my own name as Tom Savage. And the only occupation looking round where you could do that was in journalism, where you put your name on your articles, and so it was into freelance feature journalism. I would write as Tom Savage, and I hoped that gradually people would disassociate the first bit from the other bit. And that is more or less what happened, because by a fluke, because I had a social science background, shortly after I started to do writing, a man asked me would I teach in the School of Journalism in Rathmines. And that same man was on the panel that was doing a thing called It Says in the Papers in RTE. And he said to me one day, Tom, why didn't you apply for that programme in RTE? And I said, but they wouldn't take me. He said, well, they might, they need somebody. So I did a test and I got the job. And next minute, so not next minute, about what, 3 years after I left, suddenly I'm back on air as Tom Savage, which meant that what I'd hoped to achieve was gradually being achieved. But if you said to me on that date when I first went in to do my first ever broadcast in RTE that someday in the future you will be in what's known as the third floor of that building as chairman of the board or the authority, I would have said, that is never going to happen.
So, car communications, was that the first job that you had in the communication?
Yes, I started as a freelance journalist, and at that stage, about a year after I started, I started to work closely with a woman called Terry Prone, who was a close friend of Bunny Carr's. And Bunny said, oh, I must get him in to work with us in the communications training company.
Because, Tom, they were two very famous people at the time, weren't they?
Oh, they were. Oh, very, very well known. I mean, I was well known to a minority group. Well, not a minority. Some people still remember me as Father Tom Savage, who used to do Outlook. So depending on where your loyalties and what programmes you watched. But Bunny and Terry were, well, particularly Bunny was huge. I mean, he was a megastar in Ireland. But he asked me to come in, and he found that the combination of things that I had, because oddly, as a priest, when I used to go around the country giving missions and retreats, and at one stage I gave a retreat in Whitehall in Dublin, and I can still remember the posters for it outside. Said, you know, retreat for the youth of Whitehall, given by Father Tom Savage, introduced by Jacob's Award winner, Mr. Bunny Carr. So he had seen me do this, and he said, look, this guy knows how to communicate, I must get him to teach priests. So I had worked with Bunny teaching priests in the Catholic Communications Centre. And when I then left, he then came back to me later on and asked would I come in to work with him in the commercial organisation that he had set up.
Isn't it amazing how things can twist and turn to your advantage?
Yes, I've just recently read a book called The Black Swan, and it's very intriguing as a book. It's very hard to understand as a book as well. But one of the things it says is you can almost never chart the course of where your life is going to go. But all you can be is ready to grab the opportunities as they arrive, wherever they come from and by whatever forces or serendipity that create the opportunities. And effectively, that's what I did. I knew that I did want to get into communications to change the name, but what branch of it and where it would take me, not a clue did I have.
Now, you mentioned Terry Prone there, and was it at that time that you formed a relationship with her, or was that later on?
No, while I was in the business of trying to learn communications, I'd left the priesthood and I was trying to learn journalism, and Bunny told me that Terry was somebody who was terrific journalist, I knew the business, and I remember going to her and saying, do you understand about how you do publications, how do you edit magazines? And she taught me all the business at the time. And I went to a marvellous man who was very helpful to me called John Peacock, who was the secretary of the Vincent de Paul. And I said, the trade union needs me to show earnings from journalism or they won't let me become a freelance member of the NUJ. And I said, John, would you mind? I was at that stage on a freelance pro bono basis editing the bulletin of the Vincent de Paul. And I said, would you mind giving me a little document to say that I'm earning £2,000 editing the Vincent de Paul? He says, as long as I don't have to pay you £2,000, I have no problem. I said, no, I don't need money. I just need a written document. So he did. And as a result, because I was able to show the union that I was earning money from journalism, I became a member of the NUJ, which I'm still a member of today.
So, get back to Terry.
Terry then was the one that, as I was in that, taught me the business of journalism, the business of writing, and I had always been quite good, and this was why I had a reasonable success in television, I'd been quite good at speaking, but I had never learned the craft of writing, of journalism, and she was the one who taught me all aspects of that, and I learned enormously from her.
So how long was it before you got married then?
Well, you see, the first thing you had to do was you had to apply to Rome for, is it called excardination from the priesthood? It's, you have to be laicized, or as they say, reduced to the lay state, just to keep you in your box, Harry. At that stage, it was very clear that you were being reduced again to the lay state, and I had to put in a formal application, and it actually took 3 years before that came through.
And only I didn't know that, actually.
Oh, yes. Yeah, because 6 months after I had applied, I rang a friend of mine in Rome and I said, would you ever take a look and see how is my application for reduction to the lay state, how is it coming on? And he said, you're not even on record. And I said, what? He said, you're not on record at all as having even applied. So I jumped into my car, very angry, drove to Araceli in Armagh, went to the Cardinal and said, Cardinal, I believe that my application has not been processed. And I suppose he honoured me by saying, no, I hoped you'd change your mind. So I didn't send it in. So I said, well, Your Eminence, I'm quite flattered by the fact that you hoped I would change my mind. But if that doesn't appear in Rome within the next 3 months, I'm going to write about it in the Irish press. So he didn't fancy the notion of publicity about it. So my application duly went through.
So were you having going out, shall we say, with Terry during all of this time?
Well, I suppose, yes, you would say that. But I was too busy trying to make a living. Because remember, I had nothing. I mean, in fact, I was a minus quantity. A very decent friend of Bunny's accepted me into the bank when I was minus £700. And it was pounds then, which was a miracle at the time. So I was so busy just literally trying to earn freelance earnings, because I did make a resolution that having been in the system of the church, I would never belong to any business or system again unless I owned it or owned part of it, because I always felt I would be compromised in the freedom I would have to make a decision if somebody else really had me over a barrel, because I needed to sort of keep an eye on my earnings. And that was the resolution I made, and I've kept that all my life.
Before we start talking about RTE, how far did you keep working with Car Communications for long? And then when did you start your own business with Terry?
Oh, that's only 5 years ago. For all the time up to then, I was with Car Communications, but I was freelancing with Car I was in Car Communications. I also worked in RTE. I worked for a number of years in the School of Journalism in Rathmines. So I always felt that I had a number of different areas where I earned my living.
The opening a new business, like with Anton and Terry and the other gentleman, I can't remember the other gentleman's name, and yourself, it is very, very successful. And I have to say, only just last week, you're the best golfer in, well, you used to be the best golfer in the world, but Rory McIlroy has come on board. That must be a brilliant thing for Terry.
Yes, I mean, it is a huge coup, but it's also, it's a great good news story, because without going into all the details of it, Terry spent the last few years being great friends and also great professional help to the man who became the key person in the business affairs of Rory McIlroy. And when Rory McIlroy decided to set up his own what he calls Rory McIlroy Incorporated, he wanted this man to become his chief executive. And this man said that he would, as long as he was able to hire what we now call ourselves the Communications Clinic, with Terry as the head, to be his communications consultancy organisation nationally and internationally. So it's a great thing for us and for them.
And we all hope, of course, that he gets back to what he was.
I have no doubt he will. I have genuinely no doubt he will. He is probably the most talented golfer that has arrived since Tiger Woods.
Now, we wouldn't have time even to think about going through all with RTE, but you're the current chairman, and RTE over this past couple of years, they've gone from, I suppose, a lot of problems with the different things. But as chairman, you're only there since 2009, can you see, with all the opposition that they have now with all the other radio stations and television stations, can you see the future bright for them?
Yes. The minister responsible for us, to whom we report, has recently said that RTE will be able to have what he calls the media charge, referred to it as a budget. You see, at the moment and up to now, RTE has always had two legs, financial legs, that kept it going: the licence fee and commercial revenues. Now, commercial revenues have fallen literally through the floor. for all sorts of reasons, and they'll never come back in any significant way. And also, the license fee was always unpredictable in that we were never responsible for collecting it, and it could swing reasonably.
Tom, would you have preferred if RTE were able to collect that?
No, that would require setting up a whole administration to do it. But what we would prefer, and it looks like this will now happen, is that we had a very set budget, which the media charge eventually will give us, so that you could plan, knowing that is the minimum you have for budgeting, plus then whatever additional you can manage to recruit in commercial advertising. So it should give us, even though in the short term it's a huge problem, that we've had to cut back, we've had to take out and make efficiencies in the building, we've also had to lose staff, key staff. So all sorts of changes have had to take place to make us very cost effective with reduced income. But when that happens, I think we'll be able to plan how to be a good public service organisation into the future, long after my term is done.
Now, there's a few things in RTE that we have to kind of talk about. For instance, now, Morning Ireland, which is one of the most successful programmes. Everybody listens to Morning Ireland. Even when I was on Dundalk FM, I listened to Morning Ireland before I came in. And you were very much involved in the very, very beginning of that. That must be something to look back on with great fondness.
Oh, absolutely huge pride. I mean, when eventually I kicked the bucket, Harry, I don't know whether international people will know what kick the bucket means, but when I die, and when somebody is saying something about me, I hope they won't forget two things. One is that I was an All-Ireland medalist and a Secretan Cup holder in football. Maybe I should reverse these. But also that I was the first full-time producer of Morning Ireland when it began in 1984. And it came at a time when the chairman, the man who sat in my seat at the time, 6 months after Morning Ireland started, when I was not involved, said, this programme should be taken off air. Ireland has no appetite for current affairs early in the morning. Let's go back to music and playing records. And when the chairman is saying that, you know there are difficult times. And about a week after he said it, I was asked would I take over as editor-producer of the programme. And 2 years later, when I completed that, because I did it as a freelance activity rather than as a full-time staff member in RTE, when I finished that, it was the highest recorded audience programme in RTE and has remained so to the present day. So I take an enormous pride in seeing the success over all the years of Morning
Ireland. And with different presenters, the whole format of it is the key to it.
Yes, it has. And I mean, obviously, the format, the production values, the way it's been done, it's been a marvellous programme and it still sets the standard.
The whole thing with Sean O'Rourke and Pat Kenny over this past couple of months seems to have settled down a bit until the figures come out, of course, which should be out, I think, quite... It's next year. It takes a year for them to come out, I think. But what was the whole thing about? Was the board happy to get Sean O'Rourke in instead of Pat Kenny, or would they have preferred Pat Kenny to have there and didn't have to go through all that?
Well, you see, there's a whole lot of elements contained in that question, Harry. First of all, the board were very, very strongly criticised for the fact of the amounts of money that they were paying to their star performers. And over the time when I came in as chairman of the authority, as it was in the beginning, and then changed to the board, that in that time, one of its key tasks was that as contracts became due with their mega stars, that these would be drastically cut back compared to what had been agreed in the good times for the organisation. And that meant that people like Pat Kenny, like Joe Duffy, like Ryan Tuberty and so on, that as the contracts came due, they were going to have to face difficult choices. And RTE did not have much flexibility in that, because if we agreed to continue to pay at levels that either the political system or the public didn't deem to be at all valid in difficult circumstances, then we wouldn't have been able to continue. So as a result, Pat Kenny was in the situation where the new contract he was signed was going to be quite lower than what it had been before that. And he, like a lot of people would have had a lot of investments that didn't go well for him at the time, and he needed to try to meet whatever he had to do. So when somebody comes along from the outside and offers very substantial, I don't know what the actual figures were, but there were such that we in RTE couldn't afford to match, then it was a no-brainer. You couldn't compete with what the offer was on the outside. And then it was a matter of saying, well, who should we have in there to replace? Now, Pat Kenny is a man of exquisite standards and terrific broadcaster, and therefore we needed to replace him with somebody that would be a big hitter in the same arena as himself. And Sean O'Rourke has won the award as the Journalist of the Year, and he was almost an obvious choice. And I suspect that you're right, of course. It will take a year at least until the true figures, there will be figures out quite soon, but they won't really mean anything because they'll be still in the transition. But I suspect when the true figures come out in about a year's time, we'll get to the situation where I think that there's a thing in all broadcasting, which is the inertia factor. People are quite reluctant to hit the button and change their station, even where they know that somebody that they valued as highly as they valued Pat Kenny has changed. So I'm not sure the extent to which people will make the conversion. It'll be very interesting. Yeah, yeah. Certainly if the person replacing him was seen to be. The only place where that happened significantly, and even then, it's amazing, it didn't happen as quickly as people thought. It happened with Jerry Ryan. But other than in a slightly freakish situation, like the man that Jerry Ryan was, I don't expect an enormous change in the loyalties of people, particularly since RTE tends to have an audience that is fairly set in its ways, and by the time the local elections and other elections come up, I suspect that the audience will want to return to the mothership.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting. That I think that's one of the, I mean, Pat Kenny has to get it from 55,000. He should be capable of doing quite a good bit more than that. But if he can get anything at all from Sean O'Rourke's program, which is about 350,000 or something like that, it would be very, very interesting. It's fascinating.
Oh, it is. It's a fascinating dilemma. And I mean, let's also remember that Sean O'Rourke used to actually have a new peak in the audience listening when he was doing the 1 o'clock news. That if you look at the various peaks from early morning, it goes up when Sean O'Rourke took over on the 1 o'clock news. So it'll be interesting to see whether he can maintain that sort of loyalty from some of the people that he was.
He's a man you couldn't dislike.
Oh, absolutely. But neither could you dislike Pat Kenny. I mean, at a personal level, they would have been among two of the people that not only do I admire professionally, but I also admire personally, because they're both men that you would have to admire.
Tom, we have to mention Anton, your son, of course, who was on last night, and he's doing the TV3 Apprentice, the Celebrity Apprentice. And so you must be very proud of him.
But even more significant than that, Harry, he's now 5 days a week doing morning television, starting at 7 o'clock in the morning and running through. And yes, I'm very proud of him, would always be proud of him, but I'm particularly proud of him because, in a sense, the fact that I was chairman of RTE meant that if he was ever to begin a career in there, the accusation would be made that it only happened because his old man was...
I thought of that this morning. I thought to myself, I wonder will he say that to me? And you did, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because people would have said, well, yeah, I mean, no great credit to him. That's why he got to where he is. Whereas directly the opposite happened. He forged his own career outside there in the commercial world, dealing with Today FM, and thanks to opportunities, because again, I go back to what I said, that the responsibility you always have is that when opportunities crop up, that you're able to avail of them and that you pursue them with high standards of professionalism. And in taking the opportunities that he had in a more limited area outside RTE, he managed to build a career which is now very much solidly established. And for that reason, particularly, I would be enormously proud of him. And I think he's a great professional at what he does.
How long will you be chairman now? How long does your term run? And would you go for another term?
Well, no, I don't think I'd be asked to do another term. But no, I don't think so. I think at this stage, I mean, the term is this time next year I will be finished. So it's a 5-year term starting, as you rightly said at the beginning, in 2009 and finishing in September 2014. So when it finishes, I will be very happy, because hopefully we will have brought the organisation through the most difficult readjustment that it's had to make financially and professionally. And at that stage, I'll be happy to leave the job to somebody else.
Now, I left this until the very, very end. Of course, Cooley Kickhams, GAA, all Cooley. Is it changed from the time you were growing up there? Your love for it, I know, is unbelievable. Have you still got that love to come back to Cooley all the time?
Oh, I have. And I think the older I've gotten, the more I like to return both to the area, because I think it is physically a very beautiful place. And I remember a few years ago being totally startled because I invited two business friends of mine from Dublin to come down and to play golf in the open week in Greenore. And there were men in their 40s who were travelled the length and breadth of Ireland, and they said it was the first time they were ever out in the peninsula. Now, at one level, I was disappointed, but at another level, I was quite glad, because I would not want it being overrun by people coming, because we like to preserve some of its beauties. But I must say that over the years, both physically and in more recent years, now how it caters for people in terms of restaurants and facilities, it's very high-class place to be, and I'd be very proud of it. Its football has fallen a bit on tougher times. I think it's now quite a number of years since it's won the county championship.
You mean they're no good anymore? Is that what you mean?
They haven't managed. I mean, on just the Sunday before we did this broadcast, they lost out in the county final again. And needless to say, I was disappointed. But because football is such an essential part of the life of the young people in the area, I have no doubt that in the balance of swings and roundabouts that Cooley will come again, and I very much hope that I'm around to see it.
Tom, can I thank you very, very much indeed for giving up, you're a very busy man, but giving up your time to talk to us on the Gathering History project. I really appreciate it, and thank you very much indeed.
Harry, I mean, I'm honoured that I was asked. Let me just make that very clear. Because when I was growing up as a small boy, running the roads of Cooley, and I mean, I know this sounds like old people talking in my bare feet, if somebody told me that anybody would ever at some stage feel it was worth listening to what I had to say about my life and the various things I've been and done, I would have felt it was a great honour, and I really mean that.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom Savage. Thank you.
Help us make history by visiting our website on www.gatheringhistory.com.